Morning, everyone. Thank you very much to everyone for yesterday. Really enjoyed the dinner with great of the department. Again, keeping with the program, we've given a broad brief to the SSEs to present really what their conviction would drive them to present. The idea being that we wanted a broad introduction to the SME in question. On that note, I want to thank both Wheel and Philip and indeed Transnet. Again, Philip runs, I can tell you, a tight ship here now. He's on the phone to me, making sure. And Philip, I want to say thank you very much. I'm sure Wheel can express similar sentiments. Thank you very much for the way we interacted. As I said yesterday on the now, it's so easy to organize these things when the cooperation was formed. Thank you very much. So, you don't want to hear me speak, you really want to hear the representatives from Transnet. So our second time that we've had the pleasure of your company, we had it last year and we enjoyed it thoroughly. Well, again, thank you for agreeing and welcome. Stay with you here.
While Wheel is making his way up again, just so that I can account, I'd like to get you signing off on the attendance register. Thanks.
Thank you, honourable members of Parliament, colleagues, ladies and gentlemen. First, to thank Derek for introducing us, and I think for the very kind and I believe very well deserved words for my colleague, who's essentially been the person behind getting this presentation together. So I'm really just the mouthpiece. A lot of the work has been put together by her, so I'm most grateful and I'm happy that she could be acknowledged. I will essentially take us through, I think the first point in fact, which I just forgotten really was to extend an apology for our acting group chief executive, Mr. Chris Wells, who should have been making the presentation but due to earlier commitments was not available to do so, and therefore I'm making it. We will take you through the following areas, just a quick introduction to Transnet. We'll survey and probably give our own analysis of the logistics market environment, which is really the environment in which we operate. We'll then share Transnet's strategy and infrastructure plan. Some people have heard of, we talk of the National Infrastructure Plan, the NIP, the NIP, as other people would call it. We'd look into how are we financing the investments that we're making into improving the infrastructure that we custodians of. And so we're looking into the measures put in place to finance the investments. Then, of course, a big bugbear for us, which is economic regulation, public policy and economic regulation, which I think it's something that we've been trying to adjust to. And I believe that it's something equally that the regulators are trying to adjust to, and somehow I think we would ourselves equally be indebted to particularly the honourable members in helping to chart an appropriate policy and economic regulatory environment for the attainment of the goals that are sought to be attained. We'd just look into the economic challenges going forward. How do we see them? We thought it important just equally to share to the members about our corporate social responsibility. What is it that we're spending money? What is it that we're spending money on? And I hope that I could excite the former Minister of Science and Technology with what we're doing around that area, particularly engineering sciences, etc. And then we'll provide a conclusion. just if this comes out very clear, we understand the mandate given to Transnet by our shareholder, which is the government of the Republic of South Africa, as represented by the Minister of Public Enterprises, as being to assist in lowering the cost of doing business in South Africa. And I think Andrew Shaw was at our annual general meeting yesterday. The Minister made a lot of emphasis on that point, and also enabling economic growth through providing appropriate ports, rail, and pipeline infrastructure, as well as operations in a cost-effective and efficient manner and within acceptable benchmark standards. And that's pretty much critical, and our colleagues from DPE would emphasize this, because one of the key points which has been raised is that South Africa did not get the fullest benefit of the economic boom that happened until about the end, up until about September last year. And precisely because there had not been appropriate investment in critical infrastructure. And hence, when Ms. Maria Ramos came in as Group Chief Executive, she brought in the whole concept of creating capacity ahead of demand. What we got ourselves caught up in is that at the time when there was a peak, particularly in commodity demand, we sought to provide capacity. And at the time, our planning itself was faulty. I remember I joined Transnet in about June, July 2004. And I think either in that July 2004 or August, we opened up the new car terminal in Durban. And a few months after it had been opened, it was already at capacity, which suggests that also the real planning was not taking into account future demand in terms of the logistics infrastructure and operation. And so a lot of the focus which has since come in is around focusing on creating capacity, providing capacity ahead of demand. We make the point that Transnet is self-funded and does not receive subsidies from the state. And it's a point we make, and at times we make to some of our customers who are major companies, particularly many of them in the mining sector, in the mineral sector. They make, when you look at their annual financials and interims, they make lots of money. But of course, naturally, being business people, they would want to make more without having to spend more. And in some ways, there's an expectation that we should provide the capacity that they are looking for almost for nothing. And that is premised on this belief that, well, government will provide you the funding to do that. And of course, as we know, government has got a host of other competing demands for the limited resources available to it. And so what you can't have is a situation where others will just be mere free riders and make lots of earnings, but not themselves make investments to create greater capacity for themselves. Our vision and mission with the Transnet is a focused freight transport company delivering integrated, efficient, safe, reliable, and cost-effective services to promote economic growth in South Africa. And this is to be achieved through increasing our market share, improving productivity and profitability, and providing appropriate capacity to our customers ahead of demand. And the point we make around being a focused freight transport company is informed by, as you know, prior to the restructuring that went in place from about 2004, Transnet was a huge conglomerate with disparate areas of focus. Ms. Ramos would sometimes make the joke that a Transnet every idea became a company. Even a software idea would become a company. Somebody had thought up, in some people would say, if whenever someone came to a point where there were fewer opportunities of growth, there would be a company that sprang up, and that person would become the CEO of that company. And so we took all of those out and said, what we want to focus on is on transportation, on freight transportation. Passengers, we're not going to be in that. We're going to look purely on freight transportation, and we're going to do so in an integrated fashion. And if you look in places like in Brazil and in some parts of Australia, how many some of these companies, particularly the mining houses, look into the effectiveness of integrating the supply chain from the mines right up to the port, and hence we speak about delivering integrated services. The point, and many of these, I must say, are aspirational. We've set them as the vision and mission, that this is what we've got to attain. So I'm not going to lie to you and say this is what we already are. Some of them are the aspirational things. This is what we're working on. A lot of our focus is around that. In fact, we've been working now on through the strategy process. Part of my responsibility as a Transit is that I'm responsible for the group strategy and business modeling for the company. And the key marching orders has been about a quantum leap in efficiency and productivity, safety, and environmental compliance. On those, the marching orders have been that all we require is a quantum leap. For example, on safety, there's been an approach that says you've got to reduce the incident costs in respect of safety by a third. Honourable members, we have just started, so you've not missed much. We're still in the introduction. I'm Vuyo Kasha. I'm the group executive, also the group executive of Transnet. And then we look into our values, and essentially, again, the point we say we would like our customers to prefer us because we're reliable, trustworthy, responsive, and safe, and because our employees are committed, safety conscious, accountable, ethical, disciplined, and results orientated. These are the things we want to be known for. And for so long as we're not known well on any of those items, our objective is to work around that. Everyone must know us and prefer us for that, for reliability. And our lessons, we've all learned lessons in the freight transportation. I think there came a time where Transnet used to deal with customers as if to say that they had no option. That you'll take what we're offering you on rail, or you would walk. And I suppose at that time people thought that, well, they would not walk. Everybody would be stuck on rail. The truth, of course, as we know, is a challenge we have now of a lot of freight which is on road and which ought not to have been on road but on rail for a number of factors. And this is the point that we've got to make sure that our customers see us as being reliable. If you've said that you'll operate a scheduled rail, you bring your product at X time, it will arrive in Johannesburg from Durban on X day. It must happen that way and not suddenly major changes, because if that happens, business people cease to rely on you. And of course, for the success of their own businesses, they then look at other options. And so it is critical that our values remain be the ones that we've set up equally around dealing with ethical conduct. We've been looking more around just taking to Parliament, spending a lot of time and giving a lot of attention around issues of declarations for members of civil servants who are involved in businesses, etc. And of course, all of us, we have a duty to ensure that in the exercise of our responsibilities, there is not a conflict between our own personal interests and those of the businesses that we operate in. So those values around ethical conduct are critical in our business. And everything we do is intended to deal with that. And when we find lapses in that area, we've got to be able to show you that we picked up this problem, we dealt with it. We're not saying we have a holy nation operating the company, but what we're saying that those are the values. When we're failing on those values, we've got to show you what we do to deal with those values and what are the things that we put in place for us to attain the objectives of those values. These are essentially the key areas of focus to which we directed to pay great attention on by our shareholder. And that they essentially, I would call them the strategic objectives. These are, if our work is of no, whatever we're doing is really means nothing, if we're not able to attend and respond effectively to all of those. The first one is volume and revenue growth. Grow rail volumes where opportunities exist to increase market share and competitively provide services. And the key point there, I mean, and this is a point which the minister emphasized to us yesterday, that there's not going to be, there's no expectation of the idea that you will grow your revenue purely by upping prices. Revenue must be grown by creating increased activity. There must be more volumes that are brought in, that you're taking market share away from operators, particularly the road haulers, and getting it there. It's not going to be a case of we're making great revenue by pushing up prices, and the minister is strict around that. It must be around critical efficiency as well as volume growth. The other one is capital and financial efficiency, and part of that is ensuring that we continue to maintain a strong balance sheet, and as part of that, we are appropriately geared, and as matters stand, the board has set up a mandate that we should never breach the 50% mark in terms of our gearing. That's the threshold. We should never be above that. And secondly, that we should be able to obtain funding, borrowings to fund the program in a cost-effective way. And of course, the other two have an impact on the last one, because if your balance sheet is not strong, then there's an adverse impact on your credit risk. If the lenders find that, oh well, you can never be sure where these guys are, they're going to price in their risk into your borrowings, and hence you end up not being able to attain effective cost-effective funding. Operating efficiency and effectiveness, and essentially this is about operating efficiency and effectiveness in line with industry standards. And of course this is a big challenge we constantly are required to focus on. By the Department of Public Enterprises. It's not enough to say you are efficient. The question is by which standard? And you've got to start looking into comparative operators in the world to say, for example, what are your ship turnaround times in your port? What are the turnaround times for your trains? What are your crane moves per hour in your port? Are they consistent with the best of breed in the world, or are you simply saying that you will make for yourself what how best you are, or are you comparing it? So the requirement for us is that it must be consistent with industry standards, and we must have an operating margin improvement. Which is, again, this operating margin improvement must not be informed by escalating prices without any justification, but by focusing on reducing unnecessary costs, contain the costs, manage the costs, and of course part of that comes back to the point around if you're operating efficiently, you should therefore be able to do more with less. But if you're not caring about of all of that, you end up doing less with more. And the requirement placed on us is that you must do more with less. The other one is on infrastructure investments. Essentially, make appropriate investments in ports, rail, and pipelines to enable growth. And that there must be a correlation between budget and actual capital spending. Because prior to the bringing to the fore of the new strategy in 2004, we essentially were spending very, very little in investing in infrastructure and investing in creating new capacity. And I'll provide the details when you look into the changes that have happened since then in the slides that will follow. But the key point here for the shareholder said, we want to look into what you're budgeting to do in terms of providing this infrastructure ahead of demand, and what you actually get to do. And so there must be a correlation between those two. And then, of course, issues of development are part of what our shareholder has placed before us, particularly active participation programs like ASGISA, looking to issues around logistic cost reduction, skills development, BE, and one of the critical points that has been brought to our fore, particularly after... And it started really at the time when DPE brought in the whole idea of the competitive supplier development program. And as an offshoot of that is really the focus around investing in ensuring that there is a growth in the local manufacturing industry of South Africa. A lot of the things we look, equipment we look for, gets to be imported, and the challenge that's been brought to us is to look into what of those things that you would have been importing, which in fact can actually be done here in South Africa, and therefore you create capacity, manufacturing capacity in South Africa, and allow for more jobs to be provided in South Africa. And that is one of the critical issues brought up, and the minister provided a great emphasis on that at the AGM yesterday. So, in short, the Transnet challenge is to create capacity, improve efficiencies, grow volumes, and maintain a strong financial position. This is what we understand the mandate placed before us by the Department of Public Enterprises, and of course we will be hearing from Andrew sometime during the day, and if I'm wrong, he'll correct me. But this is what we understand to be the mandate that's placed before us. We just thought, let's just set out the corporate governance structure of Transnet. You have there at the top the board of directors. Currently, our articles provide for a board of no more than 18 members, and we've been we've got about 11 or 12 members, and out of the current 12, only two are executive directors. The others are non-executive directors. And that's the objective of that is to ensure that you have independent people who can come into the business and be able to direct and control the business without being constrained by parochial insider interests of the executive. So you have the majority, and our articles require that the ratio must always be that there must be, even if you're at 18, there might be probably four. You would not be able maybe to move beyond four or so of executive directors. But so there is that requirement around the mix, and what has been good Particularly with the board that we've had since 2004, and I think even before then, has been the focus around drawing independent directors. So people who have nothing to do with, who have no direct interest or connection, but who can come and provide independent direction and control for the business. And that board of directors is assisted by its four subcommittees, which is the Group Audit Committee, the Group Risk Committee, the Remuneration Committee, as well as the Corporate Governance and Nominations Committee. Below that is the Group Executive Committee. The Group Executive Committee is chaired by the Group Chief Executive of the company. So the Group Chief Executive of the company is equally the chairperson of the Group Executive Committee. And underneath the Group Executive Committee, you have the following subcommittees. One on Public Policy and Regulation Committee. As I've stated, that's one of our critical areas of focus. There's a Finance Committee. There's an Operations Committee. There's a Capital Investment Committee. There's a Risk Management Committee. There's a Human Resources Committee, as well as a Commercial Committee. The role of the Group Executive Committee is to provide strategic direction to the business. As you know, we've got different bits of divisions, which I'll show in the next slide, and we are responsible for providing strategic direction to the business and provide sufficient oversight to the operations to ensure that the strategy is successfully implemented. And this really just provides you with essentially the corporate structure of Transnet. You have Transnet Limited at the top, and then you have three focus areas: rail, ports, and pipeline. Under the rail side, you've got two operating divisions, one being Transnet Freight Rail, which is the owner and operator of the rail infrastructure, as well as then you have rail engineering. Rail engineering essentially providing assistance on the maintenance side to Transnet Freight Rail, as well as to the likes of Prasa and other players, including other players in Africa. And from there, you've got the port, which is the National Port Authority. And I think when you get in here, you must have noticed some signage relating to the National Port Authority, being the Landlord Port Authority. And then you've got Transnet Port Terminals, which is essentially an operator of port terminals. And lastly, we've got Transnet Pipelines, which is responsible for the petroleum and gas pipelines. And we've got what we call the specialist unit. The first one is the Transnet Capital Project, which is responsible for the execution of our capital investment program or infrastructure program. There's Transnet Property, which holds the Transnet property investment portfolio that we have. There's Transnet Fuel Solutions, which essentially is focused on the procurement of fuel for Transnet. We are equally great users of fuel. We've got quite a large fleet of diesel locomotives, so they spend a lot focus around that. And then Transnet Foundation, which is focused on our corporate social investment. We are just reflecting the Lux Rail and Arrivia.com as discontinued operations. They are, in terms of IFRS 5, International Financial Reporting Standards 5, regarded as discontinued because the engagements that we have on them are aiming at their disposal. Lux Rail is a business unit that owns the Blue Train. So that's the Blue Train. As I've indicated, our aim is to move totally out of the passenger sector, and that attention has been given to where that will move the Blue Train. And Arrivia.com, which we involved in together with Eskom, we're looking into what is the future there around the disposal of Arrivia.com. And this slide basically just shows all what I've said before around the various divisions of Transnet and what they are responsible for. And I just think I'll just probably focus really around the two last ones, which I've not said much around. Transnet Port Terminals, managing 15 cargo terminal operations situated across 6 South African ports and providing cargo handling services for containers, dry bulk, break bulk, and automotive cargoes. And it is getting itself to operate the container terminal at the port of Mucha, which we expect to open in October. And the other point around Transnet Pipelines, as I've indicated, transports a range of petroleum products and gas through 3,000 kilometers of underground pipelines traversing 5 provinces. And this, of course, excludes the new multi-product pipeline, which we are constructing at the moment, which essentially will replace part of the of the pipeline system that we have from Durban to the inland market in Gauteng. And this just shows the port infrastructure that we have, as I've indicated to you, but the 9 commercial ports. The point around here which raises a complementary grouping into west, central, and eastern regions. We've not worked our ports as competing ports. We've worked them in terms of each one must complement in terms of focus areas around around the key commodities that we're looking at, as well as, of course, looking to older ports that are reaching capacity and what needs to be done there, and potential for growth at newer ports, particularly the port of Mucha. And of course, we keep on looking into a number of some of our ports to see what more can be done, and I'll be showing some of the slides relating to that. On the rail infrastructure, 30,000 kilometers of track with a core network of 6,994 kilometers, and 30% of core network carries 95% of the freight volumes. This is the pipeline network that I've indicated to you, which covers both the crude line, the refined line, as well as the after line. That is, I think, the most, which was the topical issue around jet fuel. That is the line that deals with that. We then move into introduction to Transnet financial results for the year ended 31 March 2009. And we just set out before you that the revenue that we made, that is what some people would refer to as a turnover of the company for the year ended 31 March, was 33,592,000,000, which essentially was an 11.6% growth from 2008, which was 30,091,000,000. That then we look into the net operating expenses, which are the cost of effectively running the business, and you can see there was a growth in that year of 20.392 as compared to the 17.281. However, if you look into our earnings before interest, tax, depreciation and amortization, EBITDA, it increased to 13.2 billion. So there was a growth in effective earnings of about 3%. Now, of course, this must be judged against the background of an economy that went into a tailspin towards from last year, particularly around August, September last year. In fact, we made the point at the presentation of our results that our results were essentially a tale of two halves. The first half, leading to about August, September, was pretty much a good half. The second half was really a tough half, reflecting the pain that everybody had started to feel with the shrinking in the respect of economic activity. And that finally, profit for the year from continuing operations was 5 billion as opposed to 6.4 billion. And of course, one of the points one has to factor in that last year, that included the amount for the other year, included earnings that we had received from disposing of our C preference shares, which is what we refer to some investment we had in MTN. This reflects our balance sheet, and what I will really focus on in respect of our balance sheet is the property, plant and equipment side. This reflects just to allow the honourable member to settle in, we'll proceed. What is important is to reflect here the growth in our property, plant and equipment from 78 billion in 2008 to 96 billion at the end of March in 2009. And essentially, if you look into the total assets of Transnet, they have now moved at the end of March 2009 to 118 billion rand. And this is important. I mean, when you look at this in terms of the growth of the company, in 2004, Transnet had still was a bigger company in terms of various different areas of responsibilities I indicated. We focus a company around the divisions that I've previously indicated on the slide, but there's been a growth in the total assets of the company. From about that 2004, where the total assets of the company were about 70 billion, and you're now having a total assets of about 118 billion. So, reflecting equally, a lot of the investment that has been made to create capacity ahead of demand. Again, this is also the continuation of the consolidated balance sheet, reflecting the capitals and reserves, and of course there's been a continued growth in the reserves of the company, and you can see including in 2008 where it was 50 billion, which was a massive growth from where they were, and ending in March 2009 at 58.3 billion as in terms of our capital and reserves. And really what the key point I want to emphasize on in the following slides is that the capital expansion program, the capital expenditure, you've got to, if you look at what we spent in 2008, just in terms of expansion, there was 7 billion. In 2009, end of March 2009, there's 10.8 billion on the expansion side. On the replacement side, we spent a little bit more in 2008, and a little bit lesser in 2009. But if you go and look into the total that was spent in terms of investment program, the capital expenditure program for the current year amounted to 19.4 billion, which compared to 2008 was 15.8 billion, and that is excluding capitalized borrowing costs and an increase of 22 point, excluding that, it became an increase of 22.8%. As I indicated, the decline in other investing activities in 2009 is mainly due to proceeds of 5.6 billion received in the prior year from the sale of the C-class preference shares. Those are the shares I said were linked to the investment we had in MTN. What continues now is looking into the segmental assessment of the contribution provided by each of these divisions in terms of the revenue that we've reflected. And you will see Fred Zale is undoubtedly the biggest, is the biggest division, as I indicated. I mean, it has over 28 million staff. I mean 28,000 rather. 28,000 staff. I've been dealing with too many millions that I'm even beginning to think that I'm in China. So about 28 million. So
we just solved the unemployment problem, which is great news as well. Thank you.
I've been very happy to do that. Fred Zale, as I said, is at a 55% contribution, followed by National Ports Authority with a 20% contribution, Port Terminals, 15% contribution, and of course Port Terminals, the ports, that's where you can really assess essentially what's happening in the economy. When you're seeing fewer of those ships docking at the port, you know what's really happening in the economy. Pipelines, essentially the smallest division, contributing 4%, and rail engineering contributing 4%, and the other would be, for example, our property portfolio and all that, which is the 2%. Of course, if you look at rail engineering, what we're looking at there is external revenue. There is revenue which rail engineering generates, but it is from within Transnet. For example, if they're fixing the locomotives and constructing, building wagons, manufacturing wagons for Transnet Freight Rail, that's considered to be internal revenue. So we're not factoring that. When we're talking about that 4%, that includes, that relates to the work it does for the likes of Prasa. When you see all these new changes in coaches for Metro Rail, they're the ones who do that. They're the ones who do wagons also for other operators, whether you go to Botswana and other African countries. That's that external revenue that we're looking at. If you go to the Eastern Cape with the Kai Rail in terms of the Mthatha Mabele line, they're the ones who've been working on putting together the coaches and refurbishing the locomotives that are used on that line. So that money coming in from that business would be called external revenue. And so it discounts the revenue which is generated internally, which is, of course, higher because for a long time, Freight Rail had not been investing appropriately on maintenance. And there was a change around the maintenance culture. Well, if you look at, we've got quite an aged fleet of over 30 years, generally. Now, some people would say the standard should be around 20 years or so, but if you look into some of the Class 1 railways in the United States, they operate old fleets, some around the same age as ours. The difference is they've always had a sensible and effective maintenance regime. We did not have for a long time. And so we're now reaping the consequences of never having invested in maintenance. And whereas they've always had, they can keep their locomotives for long because they can maintain them well throughout their lifespan. And essentially, on the revenue side, as you can see, from 2006 up to 2009, essentially, there had been an effective growth of 8.9%, which is the compound annual growth rate over that period. If you look at 2006, the revenue was 26 billion. In 2009, it is 33.5 billion. The same thing in terms of earnings before interest, tax, depreciation, and amortization, EBITDA. A good story there. I mean, if you look at the compound annual growth rate of 15% from 2005, which was 7.3 billion, to 2009, which was 13.2 billion. And we reflect again the contributors to that. And of course, you then, which is a point the minister was sort of putting an emphasis on yesterday, is that when you look now into the actual earnings contribution, even though freight rail is the biggest in terms of the revenue because of size, you're not seeing in terms of almost a similar split when it comes to the earnings. You've got, they've got 40% and just about close to National Port Authority at 36%, whereas the revenue of National Port Authority. So, and that speaks to around us looking to building in more efficiencies in some of these divisions in order to allow them to bring in more volume and through that more earnings for the business. I begin now to look into the impact of the economic crisis on Transnet. As said, none of us has been immune from this economic crisis. At some point in some time last year, people would even speak about countries like China as being that they could decouple from all of the mess that was happening. And I remember our former group chief executive, being an economist herself, always raised question marks about this whole notion of decoupling. And of course, as it happened, there was never going to be any decoupling. The drop affected many of these countries, including those that were thought that they could decouple from this difficulty. Particularly as we know, I mean, if the likes of China have a great reliance too on consumer behavior in America, and if America is having a tough time, they're bound to have difficulties too. But of course, they're a bit more resilient than some of these countries with the numbers that China has in terms of its population and the growth plan it has. You look into the urbanization process in China and you can see that they can still generate a lot of consumption to keep the economy growing through their own stimulus packages in China. But the key point I wanted really to make here is that we too have been affected in South Africa, as everybody knows. And you can see there, in terms of rail volumes for the general freight business, which is the biggest contributor in terms of revenue, it moved off from 42.8 million tons in April, in April, that was quarter four of April 2008, and then look into quarter four of 2009 to essentially 34.5. So you see the sharp drop in volumes that have been going into rail. A bit of that in coal as well, but in some respects, coal holding off a bit better. That is the export coal compared to the others, and then you look into iron ore again. Iron ore has been a different story. South Africa has continued to export a lot more iron ore, and we've been putting off a lot of activity and investment in creating capacity on the iron ore side. And of course, we've got a ship-or-pay agreement. A take-or-pay agreement with the mining houses who are involved in the iron ore sector, the likes of Assmang and Kumba. The same thing applies, as you can see, the drop of volumes by 12% on containers, and again, on the automotive side, a drop of volumes by 24%. And just looking into the divisional overview of each of the of the divisions, in terms of we look there into the key volumes, and you can see again there a drop in terms of the volumes on the GFB side from the 82.7 million tons to 77.2 million tons. And the same, I mean, if you look again into, I just want to look into the turnaround time, of course, of wagons is also one of the key things that we look at. How much time does it take to turn around your wagons? And of course, we're picking up in some of the cases there that there was a move to more days than there had been before, into about 13.8 days on wagon turnaround time. And we also look into derailments, particularly on the freight on the freight trains, and looking into rate per million kilometers, what has been happening there. And hence the point has been made that there must be a quantum leap in dealing with safety incidents. We've got to manage safety incidents. And of course, we've got to do that into account the quality of the fleet we have and the infrastructure that we have, and hence the need to invest more in the infrastructure. Again, this is pretty much a good story around trusted rail engineering. The critical responsibility is to ensure that they increase the number of locos that are available. So if you look into the operational indicators, there's been a move from 82.0% total fleet availability to 88.4%. So they've got to make sure that they're getting railworthy locomotives provided to transit freight rail on a continuing basis. And if you look again, the same thing applies into wagon availability. There's been an increase on the availability of wagons. If you look into wagon reliability, and that's what we do is that we measure the faults per million kilometers to see whether there's reliability being brought into the fleet that is being maintained by trusted rail engineering. So if and part of that measure is to look into what are the faults per kilometer. If they're decreasing, that's a good thing. If you're having fewer faults per kilometer, as you can see has happened from 1.3 in 2006 to 0.5 in 2009. The same thing around faults per kilometer, million kilometers on the locomotives. How reliable are the locos that are being maintained by rail engineering and brought into service by Trusted Freight Rail? And you can see there that there had been a decrease of the faults per kilometer from 56.9 in 2006 to 30.4 in 2009. And of course, we've dealt with the point that the external revenue increased from 06 to 2009 by 32.9%, and the disabling injury frequency ratio improved by 12.2% to 1.15. In 2008, it was 1.31. And this is one of the key focus areas. If we've got to reduce the disabling injury frequency ratio, because that begins to reflect whether are you operating your business in a safety conscious way? Is there proper compliance to safety and standard operating procedures? And to do that, you've got to look into what is the ratio of injuries, disabling injuries that happen in your business. And hence, and the other point, the action plans are focused on improving availability and reliability of rolling stock. I won't spend much time on these slides. I mean, we've dealt with them on in a summarized fashion relating to the revenue growth on the port side, as well as dealing with the question of operational indicators. I think the key point to make here is we look into shipping delays, and that's really driven by the hours spent around the tugs that draw in the ships. So how much more time have you spent? And there was a bit of an increase of from 1.82 to 2.02 in 2009. However, if you look at the piloted side, shipping delays in terms of the on piloted side, there was a decrease from the 2.24 to 1.90. And again, the key point is to make sure that you reduce delays for ships that need to dock into our port. We've indicated the point around container volumes. They've increased from 2006. They increased, if you compare 2006, 2007, and 2008, and then you compare against 2009, you see the dip a bit in 2009 on containers. I've said you always are able to assess what's happening in the economy, but the many ships that are calling in and bringing containers. The big point, of course, is always looked at, which I know Andrew and Tim always spend a lot of time around, is the crane moves per hour. So the key test here, waiting honorable member, the key test here is that what DPE looks for from us is that there must be higher crane moves per hour. That's the assessment of productivity. So if you look at Durban Container Terminal, in 2008, you had 22 crane moves per hour. In 2009, you've got 23 crane moves per hour. This is sort of this Pier 1. We brought in Pier 1 into operation from 2007 as part of bringing in efficiencies and trying to bring in new standards of operation in the new section, which is called Pier 1 at the Port of Durban. And you can see the difference from 19 crane moves per hour in 2008 to 24 crane moves per hour in 24 crane moves per hour in 2009. And the key point that's to be made, we're required to increase that. That's the focus is around, you've got to move your crane moves per hour higher. And that's one of the critical assessments for efficiency. People will look into, if you're spending more time doing less, then you're not efficient. And so you've got to have more crane moves per hour. There must be greater activity there. And we will make arrangements to the department to take members and through the chairperson to self citizen of the portfolio committee, to take members of this portfolio committee to the site of our businesses, so that some of these things that we talk about, you can have a sense of exactly what's happening. And you can yourself say, well, if you've seen probably in the different ports that they move cranes far quicker than yourself, why is that not the case? And we've got to then explain to you what are the steps that have been taken to deal with that. But the key critical factor is that we've got to increase crane moves per hour in our port. Then you look into, this is now transit pipelines. Transit pipelines, really, I would say this is one of the most efficiently run businesses that we have. I mean, and that is, you look into in terms of the volumes, they continue to push more volumes. We've got a constrained capacity on the Durban-Johannesburg pipeline, but they've looked at mechanisms to increase volume through that. Part of those have included some bridging plans, including what we call the introduction of drag-reducing agents. The scientists within the room might know better than me on that, but there's some agents which you drop in into the pipeline to reduce the friction and therefore allow you to transport more volumes of product than you would ordinarily transport. And you can see, I mean, from 2006, they used to move 2.99 million liters per kilometer. In 2009, is 3.76 million liters per kilometer. The same, I mean, you look into the crude pipeline, reflecting a maximum utilization of the network. And all of that is a result of part of the bridging plan that I've indicated around the introduction of drag-reducing agents. Unfortunately, the story is a different one when you look now into the tariffing side. where if you look into average tariff increases, in 2008 we're given a nil increase, in 2009 we're given a 4.6% increase, in for the year that will end in 31 March 2010 we're actually given a 10.4% decrease, which is part of the issues that we're struggling with around understanding the economic regulatory environment we're dealing with, and we'll deal with the slides dealing with that. And of course, NESO's ruling on tariffs for 2009-10 reflects a loss of revenue of approximately 1 billion rand. So alternative funding options for the NMPP have to be pursued and are being pursued to ensure that we're able to provide the new multi-product pipeline that's required, because if we don't, there are going to be major challenges around energy security in terms of petroleum products in the Indian market. So for us, it's been a case of we don't have an option to simply say we don't have the money to roll out that and not do it. We cannot, the consequences that would be encountered if we don't put together that pipeline by 2011 are too ghastly to contemplate. And so we're working with, assisted by our shareholder department, in finding solutions to ensure that the new multi-product pipeline continues as it is continuing in its construction.
Just a question on clarity on that slide before.
Okay.
Can you just explain to me how do you work key volumes? Is it milliliter per kilometer? Is it not milliliter per hour or per size? How does a milliliter per kilometer give you any indication of what it does? I mean, if it's the volume of the pipe
for a kilometer,
we have so many
millimeters
inside there, what is that?
I suppose, I mean, not being an engineer myself, I'll venture an answer. The key point is the key factor they're looking at is the utilization of that pipeline. Is the volumes that are drawn. Now, of course, this pipeline is already a constrained one in terms of capacity. As the honorable members would be aware, the reason why you have many of the trucks carrying petroleum products on the road is because we don't have capacity. And hence the new pipeline is a bigger pipeline of 24-inch pipeline that we're now constructing. Now what they're looking at is the efficiency for them is to what they could do within the restrictions of the capacity that we can take to move more. And as I understand, what they've done is one of the key factors is to reduce the friction through the use of the drag reducing agent, and therefore allow more product to go through. I think that's the best I could give you to that. And I think when we take you through the business, you'd have more of the technical guys who would be able to provide it technically how all of this works, and I'm sure even when we come before the question that you have, sir, when we come before the parliamentary committee as part of the annual reporting process, the CEO of Southern Pipelines, Sal Muller, will be there and will be able to provide to deal with that more scientifically. What is that? But what we've reflected essentially is the increase of the liters, of the million liters that are transported per those kilometers. Okay. This is really a glance at the new shareholder compact. It was signed yesterday by the Minister of Public Enterprises, as well as the Chairman of Transnet. And this is really, as I indicated to the honourable members before, is that we're operating on a compact setting out key performance indicators that have to be complied with, and those are set out there in terms of volume growth, and it splits out, it splits for all of the divisions what the unit measure in terms of volume growth. Tariff increases, and again, if you look into, for example, around on the group side, the point that's been made is that tariff increases must be equal to no greater than 11%. So the key point is this, as I've indicated, is the focus around your revenue must not be driven more. I mean, your revenue must be driven less by tariff increases than by activity. So when you look, for example, the issues around, we've dealt with around turnaround ship, turnaround time, trade moves per hour, is if you do more activity, that must result in you making more money without having to up the prices too much. And of course, the other point, if you look at TNPA and trusted pipelines, those have to be determined by the regulator. The tariffs to be charged by TNPA and trusted pipelines are determined by the regulator, with the port regulator in respect of TNPA and the National Energy Regulator of South Africa in respect of TPL. And this, I mean, these are the various measures that I've indicated which are being looked at. For example, on one of the key points around risk and safety is that the total for the group in terms of the disabling injury frequency ratio, it must not be greater than 0.87%. So when I showed you about that 1.13, that is still not enough. But the focus is to ensure that you operate in the business efficiently and safely. And of course, it must be understood, and if you look into people who focus more around the mining sector, they focus around looking at the injuries in the mines and all of that, and the same thing applies to us looking into our business to ensure that, and part of what the shareholder says is that you must reduce the number of incidents that may result in disabling injury in your business.
Those figures, the 11% and the 0.7%, are they standard, are they internationally benchmarked? How are they arrived?
Now, they
in fact, I want to know how do they compare with international.
Well, I think that the benefit we have is that being the compact, being the figures being set to us, the target set for us by DPE, they would be able to deal with those figures that we've been set, those targets that we've been set to comply with. The other ones that we've left, as you can see, we've left TNPA and TPL because those are determined independently by the regulators.
And essentially, that's where the
Average total assets.
On total assets, but under financial value creation.
You want to get growth there.
And you can see that we push quite hard in this area. Now, part of the challenge there is not making good these sort of assets as comparable businesses overseas. Of course, they invested a lot of money in new assets, so there's a lot more asset value as we are in there. But then the challenge for TransPay is to actually move to greater asset utilization over time. So that's a really tough stretch target that is in second place. So each one of these are, you go through a negotiated process, and ultimately, the CEO and then the board has to sign off, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct. As the current shareholders' compact, there was about 2 weeks ago or so, there was a board meeting that approved, and as a result of that, at the AGM yesterday, the minister and the chairman could sign it. And the minister, of course, was in a more pointed fashion on this, together with the deputy, who also wants to take a more robust look around this, and made the point that it's going to get tougher. But the key point, which is looking annually, so that's part of the measure. So our shareholders set up the target, so our performance must seek to meet that, and it's a tough one. I mean, if you look into the return on average total assets, it must be grow for the group by equal to over 6%. And it's exactly for the reason that that Andrew is saying that, look, you've been putting a lot of money into these assets. Are you sweating these assets effectively to earn the return that is appropriate to earn, and looking to other benchmarks? The cash interest cover, and that is essentially what we talk about, cash interest cover, is essentially about the amount to which the money that you're making in business, the number of times it can cover the interest on your debt. And so some people say you can keep it at 1 or 2%. Of course, seriously, if you're more around the 3 or so, the lender says we can trust on you to be able to pay us the money that you're borrowing. If you're weaker there's a lot of fear. The same point around gearing, it sort of works out for next year to be equal to, but not greater than 44%. Whereas the board has always set up a standard that it should never at any point reach 50%. Now, if you look at this, it's a critical challenge because you are making major investments of 80.5 billion rand. And part of that investment is being made not only from the earnings that you're making, there's a difference is made from borrowing that you're making elsewhere. But you've got to manage your borrowing that you're not so exposed in terms of your debt that you've got a higher level of debt relative to equity. So that the gearing is critical. That's one of the key focus areas that are being looked at. And again, I mean, the same thing, you can see a requirement for increase in terms of capital expenditure, from which I mentioned that we spent about 19 billion in the past financial year. We now require to spend 21.9 billion as a requirement for that. In order to create the capacity that is required, and this is just to provide you with a sense of what it is that is being expected of us. Sorry, what have I done? This is really just providing an insight into the global logistics industry and making the point that right now it is experiencing great challenges and changes. And on the market side, there's rapid expansion of international trade in most regions, and particularly in Asia, and many supply chains are now turning to be truly global. On the expectation side, global competition in product and services markets is driving higher standards and lower costs in logistics supplier markets. You're not going to be in the game unless you're able to be efficient and drive lower costs. If you run the business very costly, you're going to be left behind. Competition, despite some industry concentration, the freeing of transport markets is creating greater contestability in logistics services and sub-markets. And that's one of the points. That technology, all modes of transport are investing to obtain more efficiencies usually larger vessels and vehicles and improved traffic dispatching, monitoring and control capability. And when you come, when you visit the port of Durban, when we take you through the port of Durban, you'll begin to see the kind of technology that's got to be brought in to make sure the processing also of the trucks that are coming in can be done quicker, and that you don't create a logjam of trucks getting in and out of the port. And a lot of technology is brought to bear in that. The point we're making here is that customer requirements today, when you look at customer requirements today, that global shipments, multimodal solutions, what we deal with, what that really means, and integrated logistics solutions. People want to have a total link in the chain, in the supply chain, not breaks in the supply chain. And when we change around the strategy of the company and ultimately the rebranding of the company and basically talking about one company with one vision, operating on an integrated platform, you could have a situation before where you'd have a customer, his goods land in the port of Durban, and they will be handled by Transnet Port Terminal. Transnet Port Terminals will allow you a certain time where when you can have them stored for free. But after a certain time, they've got to be off there or there are penalties. And then there was this one case where Transnet Port Terminals was imposing a penalty on customer X because they've not moved their cargo by a certain time. And customer X was complaining that, no, how dare you do that? Well, the reason I've not moved that is that your rail guys have not moved my cargo. So you needed to then provide a seamless operation where we can see through all of what's happening. And there's no room for alibis by anyone. You can see exactly how efficiently the supply chain is operating. Because the key point is to increase the flexibility of supply chain. And that requires globally active logistics providers with a closed mesh network, with globally valid standards, the point which Andrew had dealt with central decision-making competence. You can't, as I said, the example I've made of this person, you can't be sitting there as Transnet and wanting to penalize me through one of your divisions when your other division has not ensured that everything has worked well. So you need to be able to have that central decision-making competence so that there's no lies in the system. You know exactly what has to happen. You need efficient IT systems. You need flexible service packages and the capability to quickly offer bespoke customer solutions. The key point we've got to every time understand, don't offer customers the solutions you think they want. Engage with customers, and that's what we've been doing when we set up the commercial function. Engage customers to know what it is they want. Don't sit in Carlton Center or Nyanda House or somewhere in Devon and say, I know what the customers want, but you've never been to them. And the key point which really started off with the former group chief executive was saying, you need to get off from your offices, be there with the customers. And in fact, if you go to one of the points we'll take you at some point when we take you through the business, is the operating center for rail. And we have a whole set of IT equipment and all that, but you will have the people who are in charge of ensuring everything goes right, as well as the customer representative. So you will have a Kumba representative around so that if something went wrong, you're able to consult with the Kumba guys, what can we do, rather than say, think for them and do something which is not consistent with their expectations. So the key point was that your solutions must be tailored to meet the interests of the customers. And what we begin, this slide basically says that there's consolidation happening within the logistics sector. Every now and again you hear of mergers and acquisitions. Everyone is looking at creating bigger, more effective structures. rather than each one doing their little piece on their own. So the trend is towards oligopoly structures and mega mergers in the transport market, as this makes collaboration easier. So Transnet is similarly pursuing an integration strategy, as we've indicated to you, that we've said you must operate this whole chain from the mine to the port in an integrated fashion if you are going to be as efficient as the other players are doing. If you want to be efficient as the likes of Vaal in the mining operators in Brazil, who operate the supply chain, you've got to be integrating your supply chain. If you want to look into the likes of BHP Billiton in Australia, look into what is being done to integrate the supply chain. And that's for us, it's always been strong, the point we make, that keep the business, this critical supply chain, integrated. Keep it as the government has determined that it be one integrated supply chain effective to meet the demand. Here we provide that the South African freight system is performing relatively well. Emphasis here, relatively well. This is not, we don't look at that and say, oh, we've reached, but we're far from reaching what we've got to be looking at. But at the same time, as South Africans, we are in the habit of never seeing anything good about ourselves. We're so tough on ourselves that at times we fail to look into how are you comparing globally. And so you look at this study by the World Bank, Connecting to Compete Trade Logistics in the Global Economy. This was in October 2007 study. And what you see here is that high-income countries are generally top performers, but there are big differences between countries at other income levels. South Africa is placed 24th out of 150 countries and is the highest-ranked middle-income country in a list which includes Malaysia, because we always just think that everything that's perfect is there, 27, Chile, 32, Turkey, 34, and Hungary, 35. We're not saying we're where we ought to be. I'm not suggesting any of that. In fact, you've seen from the shareholder compact that our shareholders have given to us, it tells us that we want you to do more. But at the same time, it's important to understand that South Africa's freight system, and South Africa's freight system is not only Transnet. Transnet is a critical player in it, but there are other players. It is performing relatively well. I mean, if you look at Singapore, Netherlands, and Germany, of course, are the top three ranked countries, respectively. And you can see, of course, what happens in the ports in those respective countries. But again, the point you see, if you look into the likes of the Netherlands and Germany, people are looking for integrated supply chain. The point around Transnet is, whether it was by design or not, the government of the Republic of South Africa worked out something more strategic in being able to have the custodianship of all these critical sectors, the rail, the ports, and pipelines, integrated. Because if you go to the likes of, you'll find the likes of Deutsche Bahn in Germany, they would be more interested in acquiring ports to complete the effectiveness of their own supply chain. So we already have that. We've got to keep it that way, but we've got to make sure that it is efficient. What you don't do is break that, and in fact you then go opposite to what the whole world is doing, where everybody is wanting to integrate supply chains, you break them apart. But and hence, I think this was one of the points I think was mentioned I think Ms. Mento, you may recall when we came before your committee, I think by the Deputy Minister, is that the focus is, when the Deputy Minister correctly made the point, it is not Transnet's responsibility to decide whether it remains within the state or not, but government continues to see the strategic role it plays as an integrated business. But then you look at, I mean, China is a top performer amongst lower middle income countries, but South Africa is ranked higher than China on trade system performance. India is a top performer amongst low income countries at 39. South Africa is still placed higher than any of these. So the key point we're making here is to say we've got to improve our efficiencies of the freight system network here. But people must, we must not delude ourselves to say that we're the West. Out of 150 countries reviewed and assessed in this study by the World Bank, we placed at number 24 against 150 countries. Of course, the big problem we have is that is the challenge around connectivity. We're pretty much far from many of the major trading blocks. And so the connectivity is a challenge in terms of the shipping connectivity. From where a lot of global trading is happening to where we are. So as a result of that, if you look into this, you see with us, you don't find as much in terms of the intensity of global shipping, in terms of numbers of ships sailing around. We need to draw more. But we're so far away, and that itself creates a higher cost because of where we're placed in the world in terms of from where the key markets, the northern markets are. You've got to deal with the question around. And now, as a result of that, Africa's share of global trade has been declining for decades, from nearly 4% in the 60s to under 2% today.
It's a combination,
and I'll deal with that combination. It's a combination. It involves, firstly, I would argue, lesser competition in the shipping market. And because there's lesser competition, there's bound to be higher costs. There's fewer bigger players, and therefore there's higher costs. So then, of course, there's the question around distance, too, has an impact. But of course, what it tells us that you then have to start, which brings us to the next slide, into what are the solutions to that challenge? That we can't change where we're located, but we probably can strategize differently about how we operate the logistics system, even though we're located. So, a regional approach is required to build economies of scale and drive transport systems efficiency. So one of the key points we've got to start looking at is how do you begin to build a hub port system so that you then have links, particularly for south-south trade, to creating what we started thinking around, we've got to create a hub port in South Africa. And when you've got a hub port, and then you can see these other linkages, and then start looking into short sea shipping. So draw a lot to this hub here in South Africa, and then bring more cargo going to the rest of the region through short sea shipping. Which we're looking at that it could create new business opportunities here in South Africa, for example, around operators of short sea ships that are going to all of these other ports. So you don't have these big shipping vessels having to make multiple stops. They come here, you're creating a shipping hub, and then you've got short sea shipping. And the aim of this is that this is informed by the fact that volumes are critical to increasing connectivity. Now, if you're not having a lot of volumes coming, there's going to be, we know it with everything. If you're transporting more things, if anything you do, the more you're able to drive costs low. But if you're not being able to draw in more volumes, you have a challenge. SA's market's too small to compete successfully. So we've got to look into that. And of course, some of the strategic government issues that have been raised around local manufacturing are aimed at ensuring that we create internal capacity. Of course, the good point for us, the regional growth prospects are stronger than ever in Africa. So we've got to take advantage of that in terms of our own connectivity around Africa. Regional trade systems need to consolidate to drive down costs and increase connectivity. So we've got to look into what are the mechanisms that we can bring in to increase connectivity as well as feeder system opportunities for BEE. And that means, for example, around short sea shipping that could come in. And that comes back to the point, Ms. Mentor, that you've been raising. I mean, the point here, we said ocean trade costs impact greatly on South African supply chain competitiveness. These are the costs, you've got them yourself there. Ocean transport costs for imports, 68%. So when people complain around costs, it's not always the costs that are driven by ourselves. We have no control over that 68% on the import side or the 60% on the export side, on the transport side. Those, we don't own we're not in the shipping business. But we have a control, of course, over our costs around the port. We have a control, we can participate around and assist in dealing with inland terminal and trunk lanes, particularly the lakes of city deep terminals. We can do something about those. The same thing on the export side. But of course, the other point you've got to bear in mind when you're dealing with South Africa is that our industry development was not really worked out always in a very sensible and smart. A lot of the industrial heartland is Gauteng, very far away from the port. So there's a high lag of transportation from the port to Gauteng, whereas in many other countries you'll probably find close to where the porting areas, greater industrial activity. And of course, that goes back, I mean, you look now around the port of Muha. When they talk about the IDZ concept, look into what more activity could happen there. But we've got to be looking into creating a lot of industrial capability closer to your ports, so that you then don't have to spend a bigger leg of the transportation from the one area to the other. In fact, I was talking yesterday with one of the directors of Transnet, who happens to be the chairman of the Spark Group. And I said, I was on holiday last week, and I said, in the Eastern Cape, I came across an interesting space that almost everywhere there are these major spa, what they call super spa, everywhere. So you think that there's been no economic activity in these areas, but there's so much. And he said to me that, well, you know what, we stopped having a warehouse. I mean, we built, I think they said, a warehouse around either Mthatha, but I'm not so sure where it is, but from Mthatha, but to fit into a lot of what was happening in the growth of their business of spa in the Eastern Cape. So they don't have to then have a truck that has to be driving from Durban to be getting things to where these activities happen, the major, the bulk activity. The same thing applies to us. So a lot of the costs equally relating to us have to do with land transport costs, because we equally, the areas of major areas of manufacturing are far away from where the ports are. So there's a lot of that. Well, I've now jumped some slides, probably encouraged by you, Madam Chairperson, South Africa's freight transport as a percentage of logistic costs is the highest known or measured figure in the world, and it's rising. That's a fact. So your concern is a valid concern. That's a fact. But let's look at it. Because sometimes the impression is that we are the key drivers of those costs. The key driver of this cost is road transport costs. But of course, one could look at it and say, if we bring in reliability and efficiency, you'll draw more from the road to rail, which is, would argue, is more cost efficient as well as more environmentally friendly. So the challenge is on us, and a lot of the activity we're focusing on is how do we draw a lot of the rail-friendly cargo from road to rail. Because if you look at the key transport driver is road transportation. And the point, and it's a major cost, but the, one of the key points I always have said before and in various forums, with, including Commonwealth Business Council and others, that when we don't deal with this problem, reflected on the slide carefully, you effectively find a situation where the taxpayer subsidizes the road transport players. But when you look into the full cost of the fixing of the roads, etc. So we've got to deal with that challenge. But what we're simply suggesting here is that clearly transport as a percentage of GDP and logistics costs in South Africa is high. And we're reflecting to you who are the key drivers. The key drivers of that cost is road transportation. So it's not so much about a case, I would argue, of that we need ourselves necessarily to cut prices. But we've got to provide offerings for customers to move from road to rail because it is cheaper and more efficient to be on rail, assuming, because the greatest point, as I've indicated, because I'm not here to delude anyone. I started off by saying we started off at the wrong place at this company, where at some point Transnet lost its way and people believed that customers had no choices. We're speaking now that you need to be responsive to customers' requirements. At that time we ended up saying, well, you'll see for yourself what you want. We'll give you what you believe you want. And we thought that customers had no option. And what happened in roads tells the story. We're working hard now to turn around what happened. And for us to do that, part of that is the investments we are making, the efficiencies we're driving, as well as a focus on engaging customers to move cargo flow. I mean, when you look at this, it makes business sense for a number of customers. They too, for example, want to reduce their carbon footprint. And we can be and have to be the right business partner for them to reduce their carbon footprint. But we've got to be reliable. The point I've made before is that the transport cost challenge relates to freight, not on rail. And therefore, we require an intermodal solution. We require a mechanism that makes us work in an effective partnership with road hauliers, with the other logistics players. So, for example, we get stuff from Durban to Gauteng, and then partner with the trucking guys to get it to the door. From let's say City Deep to Jamestown or wherever the place is. But what you can't have is a situation where you have this pack of trucks on the road. So that we've got, that's why we refer to, this requires an intermodal strategy. But the emphasis I want to make, the transport cost challenge relates to freight, not on rail. And of course, fuel is the largest cost driver of road freight transport. This is a reflection that road transport is 90% of transport cost, and fuel cost is nearly a third of all transport cost. So it's even worse. It's even worse when the oil price goes on the steep side. There's an impact. So if we can work to reduce that, we certainly, Madam Chair, will cooperate with the portfolio committee around what are the things that we can realistically do, and we focus around that. We believe that our shareholders' compact KPIs are aimed at exactly the same areas of concern that you have. I'm not going to spend a lot of time around exposure to fuel price risk. The key point is that freight demand in South Africa is likely to double within the next 20 years. If that is to happen, we've got to make sure that we put in the capacity required to do that. And that is, even in a low-growth scenario, a continuation of the status quo with respect to road and rail market share is impossible. So that really just reinforces the point you raised. So there's no debate between ourselves about that this is a problem which has to be attended to and has to be attended to yesterday. Really, what we reflect here is essentially we run a study through the University of Stellenbosch on essentially freight demand modeling. Because for you to know what investments you must make, you must be able to project as accurately as you can possibly do into the future around what the demand for freight transportation are likely to be. And you can see across all of these corridors increases in the compound annual growth rate. So the point I said, even in a low growth scenario, we've got to do something to meet what's reflected in the demand. Here we really just speak about the significant sustained investment that are required. I'm not going to spend much time around that, but I'll deal with it in other slides. This is just reflecting the rail network. This brings us quickly into the environmental sustainability challenge, that it is becoming fundamental to staying in business. Government has outlined an ambitious vision and has adopted a proactive and scientifically and economically robust policy framework that will ensure South Africa meets the challenges of climate change. And as we've indicated, we've got your concerns are about ensuring that we're able to meet the challenge that government has of dealing with. I think I'm running out of time. I can see about 10 minutes, 15 minutes.
I was going to say 15 minutes.
Okay, I will just. I mean, this really, I'll jump some of these slides. It's really just looking into the overall macro outlook for a number of the commodities, particularly coal and iron ore, and reflect that even in this tough economic environment, there are still pockets of opportunity that have to be grabbed. I mean, there's still opportunities for thermal coal that gets used more around for your electricity in countries like India. There's greater demand for coal. And India, of course, is not too choosy about the coal it wants compared to, for example, the European Union. And so we've got to fill that gap. But again, as we know, the Chinese iron ore imports are not going down. China, we know with China, there remains that big demand with the urbanization program to get more iron ore of good quality, and South Africa is one of the major providers of top quality iron ore. But of course, we've got to create the capacity to move more. And basically saying Australia and Indonesia, they have the lion's share of growth, yet Colombia and South Africa have relatively meager growth prospects by comparison. Whilst Russia disappears without trace when you just look into the coal sector. This basically makes the point that Europe is still the largest importer of South African coal. However, as I've indicated, Asian exporters are growing, Asian exports are growing, led by a power-hungry India. As an export from South Africa to India, because they're looking more for our coal, and we've got to look into providing capacity for that. And this is really from Frontier Advisory showing potential for growth of the growth opportunities for a number of the commodities. This brings us the point that economic challenges 2010 is expected to be a tough year for the logistics industry. So we're not operating on the basis that everything is going to be easy. We are aware that it's going to continue to be a tough time in the economic environment, and we've got to find every measure to be efficient and lower the cost, because we do know we've not come to the point where everything will say is back to where it used to be. But the South African steel demand is expected to recover from 2010. And so all of this information is important for us to know what we must do if these are the macroeconomic outlooks that we're seeing. And I mean, the difference, of course, whereas the likes of China are taking in more and more, Europe will see a decrease in steel demand for the next year. And you can see this in different areas, whether it's transportation, it's construction. It's not the same as if you look into China, where if you're running the serious urbanization program in China, there's greater demand for that. But key challenges need to be addressed: high ocean freight costs, poor regional connectivity, investment backlog in the national network, traffic demand likely to double or triple in the next 20 years, limited intermodal solutions in inland distribution. We've got to work mechanisms for moving things quicker from the inland terminals like City Deep to areas of destination. We've got to deal with skills shortages as well as limited black private sector participation. We've got to attend to that. The point I've made before around transit strategy is designed to meet systemic challenges by operating ports in a complementary manner, implementing a high-performance rail corridor backbone, integrating physical financial information flows, formulating and implementing an integrated service strategy for key customers. Don't think what they want, get to understand them. Enhancing connectivity, growing our skills base, and identifying BEE opportunities. This is essentially provides you with the journey that Transnet has traveled since 2004. We started off in 2004 saying stop the bleeding. We moved on to say stabilize the core business. We are now in 2009 saying optimize and extend growth. And all of those things that are set out there are aimed at optimizing and extending the growth. But the key point about it is that we said even though South Africa is at 24, for us to get it higher, we've got to expand our competitive advantage. So the point, Madam Chairperson, you've been raising around dealing with the challenges that remain have to be attended to for us to ensure that South Africa is globally economically competitive. And we've dealt with the business re-engineering process, looking into the strategic balance sheet management. We've attended to corporate governance and risk management, as well as transforming our human capital development. And this is essentially the growth strategy that's driving Transnet. basically focus on re-engineering integration and productivity and efficiency. Get the business to be productive and efficient. Use the capital efficiently. And I think one of the points raised is as you spend this money, your asset turnover must be more efficient so that you're not spending more money but not getting commensurate returns around it. Safety, risk, and effective governance remains a critical part of us. Human capital optimization is important. All of these things, they contribute to the growth strategy. They are the five. They are the key elements, rather, of our growth strategy. I've just indicated to you earlier that there's been a significant growth in the investment over the 4 years that we've made in infrastructure. And you can look from what it was in 2005-06 to what it became in 2008-09, essentially reflecting that we've created 18% additional capacity since 2005 with a total investment over that period of $53 billion. This is about the transit planning hierarchy around our infrastructure plan. I'm not going to go into the details around that. This really deals with the point around we've got a capital investment program of $80.5 billion, which is worked out in terms of 42% being sustaining, 58% being expansion. So there is a higher percentage going into creating new capacity. And these are some of the major investments we've been driving. Expansion of phase 1A to, that is on the iron ore channel, that is Saldanha, where we're moving. The aim of moving to 41 million tons per annum. And that's the kind of investment we've been making in the iron ore channel. Equally, there have been investments that have been made in the coal line that is linking to Richards Bay, where the export coal terminal is. We've dealt with the issue around our locomotive acquisition program, which we've addressed the committee on before when we came before the committee on, and for given the time constraints, I won't spend more time around it. But the key point that's been said, that's been placed on us, is that we now must look into increased local component manufacturing. The new container terminal at Pier 1, which I've spoken of and indicated just the increase in the crane moves per hour in the terminal. The re-engineering of the Durban container terminal and all that we've been doing there, that is to create additional capacity of 1 million TEUs, and that included key side works at Berth 204, which already has been completed. The Durban harbour entrance tunnel widening, I think this point again you've been informed of. Container terminal expansion here at the Cape Town Container Terminal. The aim of the project is to increase capacity to serve the Western Cape region. And the first 3,000 meters of a 1,200 meter new quay wall has been constructed and dredged to a depth of 15.5 meters. Handover to operations of this kind of was expected towards the it actually happened to must have been. That was this slide. I think we've not updated it. The expectation was in July. I'll just check whether that handover of the operations has happened. The delivery of RCGs, that is rubber tire gantry cranes, is expected to be as they've been delivered and they will be operational by end of 2009. And this is all really around creating greater capacity for the Cape Town Container Terminal. And of course, this is the new beauty, Buga. And we really are looking forward to the commissioning of that new port. I mean, there's not been a building of a new port in South Africa in ages. And to have a new port that will be operational, and exactly the point that we've spoken about around connectivity, if we're able to use it as we want for effective transshipment, it will make a lot of a difference. The NMPP, that is the new multi-product pipeline, I've already advised you of that. And the fact that we are spending $80.5 billion over the five-year period. But of course, there's been a scheduling way around our program to take into account of that we remain within financial parameters, we're able to meet customer demand, but also bear in mind the downturn that we've been going through. The re-engineering of the business really has been around the activity to bring effectiveness that we've been doing around operating the business in terms of effect corridors, focusing on key corridors for the business, and really engineering it for effectiveness, for efficiency. This slide is really about talking about the growth strategy. Economic regulation, one thing I've not been smart on, that's what I should have started off with. But I will jump some of these slides to really just deal to do all of this, we need to be able to fund the investments that we're doing. And more than 50% of the funding requirements for 2009, less 10, have already been raised. We're looking at diversifying our sources of funding between domestic and international markets, and we've been doing that, having an optimal mix between fixed and floating financial instruments. Because there's time when the interest rates at some point were high and translated before, locked itself into very high interest rates, and then interest rates went very low, but it was still managing borrowing costs that were very high. So we want now an appropriate mix in order for us to have cost-effective funding options. And we just reflect a number of the facilities that we have. A loan facility of 35 billion yen was signed with the Japan Bank of International Cooperation. We've also the first ECA, this is Export Credit Agency, supported funding was signed with Finvera, which is a Finnish agency on 17. How are we? We are the triple. No, not triple. We share the same rating as the country. We share the same rating as the country. What is the current with the changes now? The triple B plus, I think, something like that. Yeah. But we're sharing. Yeah, but we pretty much tagged along the country rating. And of course, that's why all of these financial measurement focuses are critical for that. And just these are possible funding sources: domestic bonds, development finance institutions, domestic loans, other international initiatives, commercial paper program that we have, global medium-term note program. This is a most interesting and exciting one. If we can get to do this, we've not placed a bond in the international market like the US, and we're looking into that.
Can I suggest that we wrap up and then in the panel discussion,
okay,
we'll have to take some of the things, questions and answers.
Okay. I think the key point, I mean, just in wrapping up, I just thought that it's important just to set out what we're doing on the corporate social investment side. That we invest in more than $141 million in the following initiatives to grow our own skills and those who serve the market in general, to improve access to quality primary health care, to develop sports, to develop and improve access to arts and culture, and provide containerized infrastructure assistance. And I won't go through a whole host of those, but I had boasted to the Honourable Member, Ms. Mangena, that to build an adequate engineering skills pipeline. We currently have 310 engineering vessels and 341 technician vessels receiving financial support and training from Transnet to the tune of 40 million. So just the investment around engineering is at that level. And I mean, if you look into, we've got programs like Sharp Minds, Get Ahead in Life, which is a math and science program, where we're spending, I think that's over 14 million on helping schools with maths and science. Health, the well-known pen and paper trade, as you know, it has 36 stops a year and delivers health care to 43,000 patients annually. This is a great miracle, I mean, a great innovation. The Trusted Pen and Paper Healthcare Train became the first South African corporate social investment to receive the United Nations Public Service Award for excellence in public service delivery last year. It's something we continue to be proud of and would love members to go and see this. I mean, as we look at it as something to be made, to even others to look into in terms of our own country primary healthcare provision around the efficiency of the pen and paper health train. In conclusion, the slowdown in economic activity is a setback to the growth path, as we've indicated, but we said we're not stopping our investment. We'll however proceed with the rollout of the growth strategy and bolster the impact of low economic growth by focusing on identified growth opportunities in domestic markets, by looking into productivity and efficiency improvements, embedding lower cost structures on a wide front, continuing planned infrastructure investments, being nimble and proactively assess key cash drivers. The one point I've left out in all of this is the key challenge that we face relates to economic regulation, around what is expected that we do and the economic regulation driving us. There are some backup slides which will provide these slides for the benefit of the committee that will be printed out for them. And I will take questions and also deal with some of the points we could not deal with because of time. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for an extensive presentation. I think it gives us the members of the committee an enormous number of opportunities to engage with you in the panel discussion. Can I propose, because I just want to try to keep us as close to the program as possible, that we take a break now for coffee and tea. I think people need to stretch as well. And of course, I'd invite you to go outside for taking your coffee by yourself, so that may not be such a good idea as it was yesterday. So we do a half an hour and get back at 11:30, and then we'll have this talk from FAA up. That'll take us up to lunchtime. I'm not sure if we'll have time for questions and answers in the next session, but then after Andrew's presentation, after lunch, we'll then invite Rio and the FAA folks as well as Andrew to participate in a panel discussion with the court. Thanks, Jeff, and welcome. My apologies. So half an hour tea and coffee break. Please stretch your leg and see you back. Thank you.
Thank you. On the, I think it's called the DPU Winter School or something like that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was just
Thank you. Okay, because we'll take about 4:30 exactly. We'll figure out from about 5:30, yeah. $17.50. Yeah, we'll try for $17.50. But we'll phone in and schedule about 4:30. So we should be there because we are against the traffic. We should be there in about 5:30. After 5 at least. Yeah. Okay. All right then. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Okay then. Thanks then. Bye bye. Hi, we did meet outside, Mary.
Can I ask you a question before we get here? I'm also asking from the floor. Not to make nothing too of myself, but I receive that there is a complaint from a travel agent, a right travel agent in London, stating that it's a very difficult to organize travel flights to South Africa.
South Africa.
Now, in their ignorance, they say, well, it's all South African Airlines' fault because it's from the market. I try to unpack the same sentence. I don't see how South African Airlines dropped charter flights. So, but the question is, it's true that it's more difficult to charter flights to South Africa than they do.
If they want to do charter flights, then first of all, they must have a license in their company or their country of origin, so that's the UK. And then they can apply to the Department of Transport in South Africa for additional charter flights. There's quite a number of charter flights coming in from time to time. There's from France coming in and so on, so I don't know what the problem from the UK would be. Well, those are the tour operators that do it during the peak season.
Yeah, but isn't it charter flight?
Yeah, some of it is charter, some of it is scheduled.
Yeah.
But that is where the ground operator also owns the airline. So it's a package that they purchase. It's not an individual that can just go in and someone to buy a ticket to Kenya. It's a total package. And one of the reasons why they can get it cheaper is they're running at very, very high loads on their flights, up and down all the time.
So this is an immediate kind of low-income tourist overhaul. Because they come back after 10 years.
Yeah.
And then after 10 years they come back and go back to New York.
Yeah, I'm not sure to what extent you'll be able to mirror what they're doing to Kenya on those places. Because the charter operators obviously have the most approach to the flight. And to Kenya is maybe 6 hours from London, you can do it, but when you get to 10 and 11 hours on the low cost scenario, it becomes a bit more difficult.
Yeah? I think people go, I'll go for one. They don't do the rest, so we have some people. It's not due to description of activities. I can take it all down to, I think it goes down to 26. I can do it all, or I can take it.
See how it goes. If you want me to take it over, I'll take it over. Otherwise, you can see how it goes. But I'm quite happy to break it in.
Yeah, because it's just the kind of like, yeah. I can do all I can do. There's a certain word that I saw, what, antiquated. What's that?
Antiquated.
Antiquated.
Old.
Oh, that's antique.
Yeah.
Antiquated. Oh, my God. You guys write English. Antiquated. Oh, what's the word? Antiquated stuff. No, I'm fine.
Oh, okay. So it's good, huh?
That's the name of the
Thank you. are not white, are just not short and male. Oh no, it's chip, but it's no male. Sorry about that.
Tomorrow there will be a meeting, there will be some meetings,
as well. We'll do the same thing for the whole day. I need to confirm that I arrived at the end. But same thing again. So the frequency is 8.59. Yeah, but I need to confirm that. Yeah, no, this is lunch, but I mean, you're not serving lunch there, but this is just got the advice. Yeah. Yeah, because they're going to have a discussion panel now. There's going to be one more presentation, maybe there's going to be a discussion panel. And there's some, like, sort of engagement with the people that are a lot of people are. As you know, SAA and Okay, and tomorrow. So then I won't be covering the meeting tomorrow. So I think like Monday, like what time do I have tomorrow? Yeah, so 8 o'clock. But, I mean, if you want to cover the meeting, then what I can do is I can just shower at the gym down the road. Okay. Yeah, I'll change that. Yes. Okay, yeah, I will do that. Okay, my God, bye. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm with the following group.